Critique of the Gotha Program by Karl Marx. Section. Part 1. 1. Quote, labor is the source of all wealth and all culture. And since useful labor is possible only in society and through society, the proceeds of labor belong undiminished with equal right to all members of society. End quote. First part of the paragraph. Labor is the source of all wealth and all culture. Labor is not the source of all wealth. Nature is just as much the source of use values, and it is surely of such that material wealth consists, as labor, which itself is only the manifestation of a force of nature, human labor power. The above phrase is to be found in all children's primers, and is correct insofar as it is implied that labor is performed with the appurtenant subjects and instruments. But a socialist program cannot allow such bourgeois phrases to pass over in silence, the conditions that alone give them meaning. And insofar as man from the beginning behaves towards nature, the primary source of all instruments and subjects of labor, as an owner treats her as belonging to him, his labor becomes the source of use values, therefore also of wealth. The bourgeois have very good grounds for falsely ascribing supernatural creative power to labor, since precisely from the fact that labor depends on nature, it follows that the man who possesses no other property than his labor power must, in all conditions of society and culture, be the slave of other men who have made themselves the owners of the material conditions of labor. He can only work with their permission, hence live only with their permission. Let us now leave the sentence as it stands, or rather limps. What could one have expected in conclusion? Obviously this, quote, since labor is the source of all wealth, no one in society can appropriate wealth except as the product of labor. Therefore, if he himself does not work, he lives by the labor of others, and also acquires his culture at the expense of the labor of others. End quote. Instead of this, by means of the verbal river and since, a proposition is added in order to draw a conclusion from this and not from the first one. Second part of the paragraph, quote, useful labor is possible only in society and through society, end quote. According to the first proposition, labor was the source of all wealth and all culture. Therefore, no society is possible without labor. Now we learn, conversely, that no, quote, useful labor is possible without society. One could just as well have said that only in society can useless and even socially harmful labor become a branch of gainful occupation, that only in society can one live by being idle, etc., etc. In short, one could just as well have copied the whole of Rousseau. And what is, quote, useful labor? Surely only labor which produces the intended useful result. A savage, and man was a savage after he had ceased to be an ape, who kills an animal with a stone, who collects fruit, etc., performs useful labor. Thirdly, the conclusion, quote, useful labor is possible only in society and through society. The proceeds of labor belong undiminished with equal right to all members of society. End quote. fine conclusion. If useful labor is possible only in society and through society, the proceeds of labor belong to society, and only so much therefrom accrues to the individual worker, as is not required to maintain the condition of labor, society. In fact, this proposition has at all times been made use of by the champions of the state of society prevailing at any given time. First comes the claims of the government and everything that sticks to it, since it is the social organ for the maintenance of social order. Then comes the claims of the various kinds of private property, for the various kinds of private property are the foundations of society, etc. One sees that such hollow phrases are the foundations of society, etc. One sees that such hollow phrases can be twisted and turned as desired. The first and second parts of the paragraph have some intelligible connection only in the following wording. Quote, labor becomes the source of wealth and culture only as social labor, end quote, or what is the same thing in and through society. This proposition is incontestably correct, for although isolated labor, its material conditions presupposed, can create use value, it can create neither wealth nor culture. But equally incontestable is this other proposition. Quote, in proportion as labor develops socially and becomes thereby a source of wealth and culture, poverty and destitution develop among the workers, and wealth and culture among the non-workers. End quote. This is the law of all history hitherto. What, therefore, had to be done here, instead of setting down general phrases about labor and society, was to prove concretely how, in present capitalist society, the material, etc., conditions, have at last been created which enable and compel the workers to lift this social curse. In fact, however, the whole paragraph, bungled in style and content, is only there in order to inscribe the Lassallian catchword of the, quote, undiminished proceeds of labor, as a slogan at the top of the party banner. I shall return later to the proceeds of labor, equal right, etc., since the same thing recurs in a somewhat different form further on. 2. Quote, in present-day society, the instruments of labor are the monopoly of the capitalist class. The resulting dependence of the working class is the cause of misery and servitude in all forms. End quote. This sentence, borrowed from the rules of the International, is incorrect in this improved edition. In present-day society, the instruments of labor are the monopoly of the landowners. The monopoly of property in land is even the basis of the monopoly of capital and the capitalists. In the passage in question, the rules of the International do not mention either one or the other class of monopolists. They speak of the, quote, monopolizer of the means of labor, that is, the sources of life. The addition, sources of life, makes it sufficiently clear that land is included in the instruments of labor. The correction was introduced because LaSalle, for reasons now generally known, attacked only the capitalist class and not the landowners. In England, the capitalist class is usually not even the owner of the land on which the factory stands. 3. Quote, "The emancipation of labor demands the promotion of the instruments of labor to the common property of society, and the cooperative regulation of the total labor, with a fair distribution of the proceeds of labor." Quote, "Promotion of the instruments of labor to the common property," end quote, ought obviously to read their, quote, "conversion into the common property," but this is only passing. What are the proceeds of labor? The product of the labor or its value? And in the latter case, is it the total value of the product, or only that part of the value which labor has newly added to the value of the means of production consumed? Proceeds of labor is a loose notion which LaSalle has put in the place of definite economic conceptions. What is a, quote, "fair distribution"? Do not the bourgeois assert that the present-day distribution is fair? And is it not, in fact, the only, quote, "fair distribution" on the basis of the present-day mode of production? Are economic relations regulated by legal conceptions? Or do not, on the contrary, legal relations arise out of economic ones? Have not also the socialist sectarians the most varied notions about, quote, "fair distribution"? To understand what is implied in this connection by the phrase "fair distribution," we must first take the first paragraph and this one together. The latter presupposes a society wherein the instruments of labor are common property, and the total labor is cooperatively regulated. And from the first paragraph, we learn that, quote, "the proceeds of labor belong undiminished with equal right to all members of society." To all members of society? To those who do not work as well? What remains then of the undiminished proceeds of labor? Only to those members of society who work? What remains then of the equal right of all members of society? But all members of society and equal right are obviously mere phrases. The kernel consists in this, that in this communist society, every worker must receive the, quote, undiminished LaSallian, quote, "proceeds of labor." Let us take, first of all, the words "proceeds of labor" in the sense of the product of labor. Then the cooperative proceeds of labor are the total social product. From this must now be deducted. First, cover for the replacement of the means of production used up. Second, additional portion for the expansion of production. Third, reserve or insurance funds to provide against accidents, dislocations caused by natural calamities, etc. These deductions from the undiminished proceeds of labor are an economic necessity, and their magnitude is to be determined according to the available means and forces, and partly by computation of probabilities, but they are in no way calculable by equity. There remains the other part of the total product, intended to serve as means of consumption. Before this is divided among the individuals, there has to be deducted again from it, first, the general cost of administration not belonging to production. This part will, from the outset, be very considerably restricted in comparison with present-day society, and it diminishes in proportion as the new society develops. Second, that which is intended for the common satisfaction of needs, such as schools, health services, etc. From the outset, this part grows considerably in comparison with present-day society, and it grows in proportion as the new society develops. Third, funds for those unable to work, etc. In short, for what is included under so-called official poor relief today. Only now do we come to the, quote, distribution, which the program, under LaSallian influence, alone has in view in its narrow fashion, namely, to that part of the means of consumption which is divided among the individual producers of the cooperative society. The, quote, undiminished proceeds of labor have already unnoticeably become converted into the diminished proceeds. Although what the producer is deprived of in his capacity as a private individual benefits him directly or indirectly in his capacity as a member of society. Just as the phrase of the undiminished proceeds of labor has disappeared, so now does the phrase of the proceeds of labor disappear altogether. Within the cooperative society based on common ownership of the means of production, the producers do not exchange their products. Just as little does the labor employed on the products appear here as the value of these products, as a material quality possessed by them, since now, in contrast to capitalist society, individual labor no longer exists in an indirect fashion, but directly as a component part of total labor. The phrase proceeds of labor, objectionable also today on account of its ambiguity, thus loses all meaning. What we have to deal with here is a communist society, not as it has developed on its own foundations, but on the contrary, just as it emerges from capitalist society, which is thus in every respect, economically, morally, and intellectually, still stamped with the birthmarks of the old society from whose womb it emerges. Accordingly, the individual producer receives back from society, after the deductions have been made, exactly what he gives to it. What he has given to it is his individual quantum of labor. For example, the social working day consists of the sum of the individual hours of work, the individual labor time of the individual producer is the part of the social working day contributed by him, his share in it. He receives a certificate from society that he has furnished such and such an amount of labor, after deducting his labor for the common funds. And with this certificate, he draws from the social stock of means of consumption as much as the same amount of labor cost. The amount of labor which he has given to society in one form, he receives back in another. Here, obviously, the same principle prevails as that which regulates the exchange of commodities, as far as this is exchange of equal values. Content and form are changed, because under the altered circumstances, no one can give anything except his labor, and because, on the other hand, nothing can pass to the ownership of individuals except individual means of consumption. But as far as the distribution of the latter among the individual producers is concerned, the same principle prevails as in the exchange of commodity equivalence. A given amount of labor in one form is exchanged for an equal amount of labor in another form. Hence, equal right here is still in principle bourgeois right, although principle and practice are no longer at loggerheads, while the exchange of equivalence in commodity exchange exists only on the average and not in the individual case. In spite of this advance, this equal right is still constantly stigmatized by a bourgeois limitation. The right of the producers is proportional to the labor they supply. The equality consists in the fact that measurement is made with an equal standard, labor. But one man is superior to another physically or mentally, and supplies more labor in the same time, or can labor for a long time. And labor, to serve as a measure, must be defined by its duration or intensity. Otherwise, it ceases to be a standard of measurement. This equal right is an unequal right for unequal labor. It recognizes no class differences, because everyone is only a worker like everyone else. But it tacitly recognizes unequal individual endowment, and thus productive capacity, as a natural privilege. It is therefore a right of inequality in its content, like every right. Right, by its very nature, can consist only in the application of an equal standard. But unequal individuals, and they would not be different individuals if they were not unequal, are measurable only by an equal standard insofar as they are brought under an equal point of view, are taken from one definite side only. For instance, in the present case, are regarded only as workers, and nothing more is seen in them, everything else is being ignored. Further, one worker is married, another is not, one has more children than another, and so on and so forth. Thus, with an equal performance of labor, and hence an equal in the social consumption of fund, one will in fact receive more than another, one will be richer than another, and so on. To avoid all these defects, right, instead of being equal, would have to be unequal. But these defects are inevitable in the first phase of communist society, as it is when it has just emerged after prolonged birth pangs from capitalist society. Right can never be higher than the economic structure of society and its cultural development conditioned thereby. In a higher phase of communist society, after the enslaving subordination of the individual to the division of labor, and therewith also the antithesis between mental and physical labor has vanished, after labor has become only a means of life, but life's prime want, after the productive forces have also increased with the all-around development of the individual, and all the springs of operative wealth flow more abundantly, only then can the narrow horizon of bourgeois right be crossed in its entirety, and society inscribe on its banners, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. I have dealt more at length with the undiminished proceeds of labor, on the one hand, and with equal right and fair distribution on the other, in order to show what a crime it is to attempt, on the one hand, to force on our party again, as dogmas, ideas which in a certain period had some meaning, but have now become obsolete verbal rubbish, while again perverting, on the other, the realistic outlook, which it cost so much effort to instill into the party, but which has now taken root in it, by means of ideological nonsense about right and other trash so common among the Democrats and French socialists. Quite apart from the analysis so far given, it was in general a mistake to make a fuss about so-called distribution and put the principal stress on it. Any distribution, whatever, of the means of consumption is only a consequence of the distribution of the condition in themselves. The latter distribution, however, is a feature of the mode of production itself. The capitalist mode of production, for example, rests on the fact that the material conditions of production are in the hands of non-workers in the form of property and capital and land, while the masses are only owners of the personal condition of production, of labor power. If the elements of production are so distributed, then the present-day distribution of the means of consumption results automatically. If the material conditions of production are the cooperative property of themselves, then there likewise results a distribution of the means of consumption different from the present one. Vulgar socialism, and from it in turn a section of the Democrats, has taken over from the bourgeois economists the consideration and treatment of distribution as independent of the mode of production, and hence the presentation of socialism as turning principally on distribution. After the real relation has long been made clear, why retrogress again? Four. Quote, "The emancipation of labor must be the work of the working class, relative to which all other classes are only one reactionary mass." End quote. The first strophe is taken from the introductory words of the Rules of the International, but, quote, "improved." There it said, quote, "The emancipation of the working class must be the act of the workers themselves." Here, on the contrary, the working class has to emancipate what? Labor. Let him understand who can. In compensation, the antistrophe, on the other hand, is a Lassallian quotation of the first water, quote, "relative to which, the working class, all other classes are only one reactionary mass," end quote. In the Communist Manifesto, it is said, quote, "Of all the classes that stand face to face with the bourgeoisie today, the proletariat alone is a really revolutionary class. The other classes decay and finally disappear in the face of modern industry. The proletariat is its special and essential product." End quote. The bourgeoisie is here conceived as a revolutionary class, as the bearer of large-scale industry, relative to the feudal lords and the lower middle class, who desire to maintain all positions that are the creation of obsolete modes of production. Thus, they do not form, together with the bourgeoisie, quote, "only one reactionary mass." On the other hand, the proletariat is revolutionary relative to the bourgeoisie, because, having itself grown up on the basis of large-scale industry, it strives to strip off from production the capitalist character that the bourgeoisie seeks to perpetuate. But the manifesto adds that the lower middle class is becoming revolutionary in view of its impending transfer to the proletariat. From this point of view, therefore, it is again nonsense to say that it, together with the bourgeoisie and with the feudal lords into the bargain, form only one reactionary mass relative to the working class. Has one proclaimed to the artisan, small manufacturers, etc., and peasants during the last elections, relative to us, you, together with the bourgeoisie and feudal lords, form one reactionary mass? LaSalle knew the Communist Manifesto by heart, as his faithful followers knows the Gospels written by him. If, therefore, he has falsified it so grossly, this has occurred only to put a good color on his alliance with the absolutists and feudal opponents against the bourgeoisie. In the above paragraph, moreover, his oracular saying is dragged in by main force without any connection with the botched quotation from the Rules of the International. Thus, it is simply an impertinence, indeed not at all displeasing to Herr Bismarck, one of those cheap pieces of insolence in which the Marat of Berlin deals. Marat of Berlin is a reference Hasselmann, chief editor of the Neue Sozialdemokrat. Five, quote, the working class strives for its emancipation, first of all within the framework of the present-day national states, conscious that the necessary result of its efforts, which are common to the workers of all civilized countries, will be the international brotherhood of all peoples. End quote. LaSalle, in opposition to the Communist Manifesto and to all earlier socialism, conceived the workers' movement from the narrowest national standpoint. He is being followed in this, and that after the work of the International. It is altogether self-evident that, to be able to fight at all, the working class must organize itself at home, as a class, and that its own country is the immediate arena of its struggle, insofar as its class struggle is national, not in substance, but, as the Communist Manifesto says, in form. But the, quote, framework of the present-day national state, for instance, the German Empire, is itself, in its turn, economically, within the framework of the world market, politically within the framework of the system of states. Every businessman knows that German trade is at the same time foreign trade, and the greatness of Herr Bismarck consists, to be sure, precisely in his pursuing a kind of international policy. And to what does the German Workers' Party reduce its internationalism? To the consciousness that the result of its efforts will be, quote, the international brotherhood of peoples, a phrase borrowed from the Bourgeois League of Peace and Freedom, which is intended to pass as equivalent to the international brotherhood of working classes in the joint struggle against the ruling classes and their governments. Not a word, therefore, about the international functions of the German working class. And it is thus that it is to challenge its own bourgeoisie, which is already linked up in brotherhood against it with the bourgeois of all other countries, and Herr Bismarck's international policy of conspiracy. In fact, the internationalism of the program stands even infinitely below that of the Free Trade Party. The latter also asserts that the result of its efforts will be, quote, the international brotherhood of all peoples. But it also does something to make international trade international, and by no means contents itself with the consciousness that all people are carrying on trade at home. The international activity of the working classes does not in any way depend on the existence of the International Working Men's Association. This was only the first attempt to create a central organ for the activity, an attempt which was a lasting success on account of the impulse which gave it, but which was no longer realizable in its historical form after the fall of the Paris Commune. Bismarck's Norddeutsche was absolutely right when it announced, to the satisfaction of its master, that the German Workers' Party had sworn off internationalism in the new program. End of part 1.